Okay, well, I'm involved primarily at the moment in running a study where we see young children. They've usually just turned 2 or just turned 3, and they have older siblings, or most of them have older siblings who already have a diagnosis of ASD. And the purpose of the study in seeing children from actually, we don't see them here when they're very young, but they're seen at Birkbeck College at the baby lab, is that we know that a relatively high proportion of them, we don't know exactly how many, but maybe about 20% of them, will end up with a diagnosis, or at least with what we think would constitute a diagnosis of ASD. And so we're looking at the kind of the way that ASD might unfold in a child who goes on to have autism from a very early age before you could probably identify it. So my happy task usually is to I get to play with these 2 and 3 year olds, or tell my colleagues how to play with them on a what's usually a very intensive visit for these kids. A lot of the stuff we do with them is quite good fun and involves toys, and some of it is not so much fun and is so it's quite demanding for say particularly for the 2 year olds. They have to sit quite still for a long time. I also get spend a lot of my time as well talking to the parents about very specific aspects of behaviour, some of which the parents may be concerned about and some of which clearly not a problem at all. So that's a kind of an average day, I guess. The rest of the time I spend looking at documents on computers and doing all the other dreary stuff associated with research, but I'm really here for the kind of interaction with the kids and their parents. I think in a way, I guess the broad answer is yes, probably, but I think in lots of 2 and 3 year olds that we see, and given the fact that the majority of kids we see probably don't have autism and they're not, we wouldn't really think of them as being diagnosable, even if they've got some traits. It's difficult to know always how that manifests itself. So I think, whereas I'm sure that, say, for a lot of these kids that we see, if we see them again when they're 4 or 5, that attention to detail may be much clearer and it will manifest itself perhaps in a very strong interest in a particular character or an online game or something like that. Trying to identify what the manifestation of that is at 2 might be slightly different because it may be that it's not something that's so clear, you know. And on the other hand, lots and lots of kids are, you know, very interested in, say, certain TV programs and whatever. And so they may only be interested in Peppa Pig, for example. And they may come in wearing Peppa Pig clothes and talk about Peppa Pig and the different aspects of it. But it's difficult to know where that strong interest becomes like a real, kind of, almost like a problem because they can't think about anything else. Slightly missed the point of your question, though, in terms of the detail. Again, it's difficult to know whether it is like an attention to detail or whether it's just a rejection of things that don't relate to what they're interested in. But I think the challenge that we have sometimes is that we're testing 2 and 3 year olds, and your average 2 and 3 year old is not always want to do what you want them to do, both from a researcher's point of view and from the point of view of a parent whose children are no longer 2 or 3, but who's still challenging me on a daily basis. I mean, in some ways, we all have special interests. We all have things that we choose. You know, I've been a lifelong West Ham supporter, which has taught me that life's not all about winning. When I think about, for instance, one of my nephews has Asperger's syndrome, that's a diagnostic label that he was given. And to me, it was always fairly clear that he was quite different the way that he was growing up from his cousins and my eldest child in particular. And he found it difficult to accommodate to the other children's way of playing, but he was quite happy to play with them as long as they were joining in with him. And over the years, he probably has had what at the time appeared to be these kind of special interests, you know, very, and particularly computer games, specific computer games and things. But to me, it was clear that he, you know, in a way, he had a very admirable ability to kind of absorb lots of information, like, you know, the football scores, for example, and then he just knew them. You know, he could recite like 92 scores or whatever it was that they read out Saturday afternoon the next day, and you know, which is just amazing to be able to do that. And what's been interesting over the years is that whereas my sister, his mum, had always had this anxiety that he would, in a way, end up as a, you know, being isolated socially and would, you know, paired, I guess, with general anxieties these days about the amount of time children spend on computers and all this kind of thing. As it turned out for him, he's become a very good swimmer, and so he's a member of this swimming club. But he's the one that everybody turns to when they need any help with, like, oh, what was my PB, my personal best time for the 100 metres or whatever? And he will know. And so he collates all that information. He helps with the technical side of organising swimming galas and things like that. And, you know, whether at some point anybody would have said, oh, his special interests are a problem, I think mostly now people would see that he has a particular degree of ability that actually can be generalised to other things. Generally things that he's interested in, but I think he's genuinely interested in collating numbers. And, you know, he ran our family sweepstake for the World Cup and was giving people updates and had created all sorts of ingenious ways of kind of comparing one family member's selection of teams with another, you know. And it was very, it's not unique, but certainly within our family group, he was the only one who could have done that. So it's really positive. He's 16 now, so I'm not quite sure where he's going to go in terms of career, but I have no doubt at all that he will be successful in whatever it is that he chooses to do. I'm sure it will be something that is on the kind of the technical side of, you know, life, that probably involves using computers or modern technology in some way. But I'm also fairly certain that it won't be something that doesn't involve other people, because he doesn't fulfill what a lot of people would say, you know, the stereotypes about people with autism. They can't interrelate with other people and they don't understand. He may not have such an interest in other people's everyday lives or whatever. He may be a little bit kind of clumsy in the way that he interacts with people sometimes, but it's not that he doesn't, you know, he's quite a charismatic young man. He's apparently you know, had a couple of on-off relationships with some of his classmates, and, you know, and it's probably he's also had the same kind of traumas that most of us have as we're, you know, going into our teenage years and whatever. So that's been interesting for me as a kind of very personal experience of somebody within my family. And I think when I talk to parents who come in as part of our study or in other situations about their children who have autism, and it's interesting, I think in most cases people don't try to discourage what might be seen as special interests. They may be trying to encourage a wider interest in other things, including things that you just have to get on with in terms of, you know, your academic career. You know, you may be only interested in numbers, but you have to do English as well, you know, whatever. Because I think it may well be that for some people, their particular strong interest is the thing that they take refuge in when life around them is getting too complicated, you know. But it's also maybe something that, who knows, you know, in 10 years' time, they're going to be a world-leading expert on paleontology or space or whatever it might well be. And I think there's, you know, we need all of that in the world in general. You know, we need people who have got that attention to detail and the strong interest in things that most of us might find impenetrable or boring or whatever, you know. So I think it can be really positive. Oh, I think so, definitely. And I think I mean, clearly the thing about people with autism, you know, it's a real cliche, but, you know, they say if you know one person with autism, you know one person with autism. And I think that's true for people with autism as well as, you know, neurotypicals. But I'm sure that actually if you were to quantify in some way, people that have that aptitude to apply their genuine skill, whether it's whether we call it systematizing or whatever, that they can apply it to lots of different things. And I think it sometimes it may be that you need a little bit of help to realize how, you know, you can get equal enjoyment, if you like, from collating incredible amounts of knowledge about one thing and about another. Another kind of personal example would be my eldest child's, one of her closest friends from school had a diagnosis of Asperger's. And he's somebody, I think, if you know anything about autism, you'd spot him quite quickly as a person on the autism spectrum. But he's very able, he's incredibly creative and very, very unique in lots of ways. But the one thing that, you know, I remember him doing that kind of in a way showed both that he probably was a young boy with autism and that he was very unique, was that one day we went round to his house and he rushed over and he said, "I've got to tell you about the council's new innovative waste management system," because a leaflet had come through the door and he just had to learn all about it. So he'd gone on the website, he'd learned all about it, he knew more about it probably than anybody who worked for the council. And, you know, and I think if I didn't know anything about autism, I would have thought, wow, that's really strange. But I think I just saw it as like, wow, he's amassed all this information. I can't say that I'm as enthusiastic about our council's waste management system as he is, but actually I learned some things that day that on an everyday basis now when I'm sorting my rubbish, it takes me back to him and his enthusiasm about it. You know, the downside in a way, talking to his mum, was that she said there are times when if he knows there's something that he doesn't know, he almost can't switch off until he's learned about it. So it was a problem, it was affecting his sleep because he was very interested in science. I think he'd learned about there was a new kind of proton or something, some new element or whatever that had been discovered, and he just had to know about it. He literally couldn't go to bed until he'd researched it. And so 3 or 4 hours later, luckily in a way for him, his dad's very close to the autism spectrum, shall we say, and so they both sat down and researched this thing almost just so that he could switch off and go to bed. And I guess that's the kind of perhaps the other side of things that that we have to recognise, is that just being able to manage that side of things, which may express themselves through, you know, in anxiety or whatever, but it maybe it's just that, like, I need to know, I need to, you know, I can't have that ambiguity in my head and still go to bed, you know. And that, but that's probably something that for a lot of people, you know, we might say, oh, it's all right, I'll read a book tomorrow or look it up tomorrow or whatever, but he clearly just couldn't. So so I think maybe that's another side where perhaps people on the autism spectrum might need some help, whether it's from parents or teachers or others, just to be able to manage the negative, whether it's psychological, emotional consequences of having that way of thinking about the world. I think as time has gone on, I guess I've known about autism, I can probably almost date it, but when I was training to be a speech therapist, so in the early 90s, I've known about it for that long. I've worked in the field of autism since October 1995. There you go, I can almost date it. And I've seen the way in which we think about autism change and expand over that time. It seems to have taken a long time for both the kind of at the professional level, the research level, and at certainly the policy level to catch up with the idea that having autism doesn't protect you from having virtually any other condition that you might name, whether it's medical, psychiatric, mental health problems, but that clearly some of the consequences of the consequences of autism inevitably do lead to difficulties with mental health problems, whether it's due to physiological aspects like sleep problems, whether it's like the increased likelihood of having epilepsy. And I think at least now there is a growing understanding that there's a whole range of complex issues that may well be a consequence of having autism, or they may be completely independent, but that I think in the past people have almost described, you know, certainly in young children, of like difficult or challenging behaviour. Oh, that's because they're autistic. Where actually it may be that person's got a stomach ulcer, but they can't express the discomfort or whatever in the same way that another person might be able to. So I think that there needs to be a huge, if it's a shift, but a much bigger emphasis on looking at the kind of the emotional consequences of growing up with autism. I think there is certainly a bigger interest these days in looking at women and girls who are on the autism spectrum. And I've certainly met a lot of women who have been diagnosed late with autism who in lots of ways probably wouldn't tweak my autism radar when I first meet them, but who would tell me about the terrible experiences they had during their childhood and adolescence in particular, of trying to fit in and the, you know, almost, I think that some people have described it as, you know, pretending to be normal. And so the fact that they, and maybe it's something about women and girls in particular, the fact that they are able to actually do that really well, but the consequences for them, the internal consequences, are huge. And we know that certainly amongst women with diagnosis of autism, much higher rates of eating disorders and other psychiatric problems because of the lack of recognition of what was going on. I sometimes think that for a lot of people with autism, it must be, one of the things I learned about as a speech therapist was disfluency and stammering. And there are a lot of people who would describe themselves as stammerers, but who don't actually stammer because they're spending all their mental effort trying to think about how to phrase things so that maybe they're not going to have to say a particular word or a particular sound. And so as far as everybody else is concerned, their speech is perfectly fluent and nobody would think of them as stammering. And yet the mental effort that that person takes has an inevitable consequence on them. And I think for a lot of people with autism, it must be similar to that. They're working so hard to try and, you know, not to upset other people, trying to remember what the rule is for that situation and others. It has consequences on mental health, on other aspects of their kind of daily life, which for a lot of us might just be really invisible, and but these things come out somewhere. We all have to develop, I guess, coping mechanisms for dealing with all the, you know, the many predictable and unpredictable aspects of life. But if that's your kind of minute by minute experience, that must be exhausting. I think it's absolutely crucial. I'm aware of the fact that within the kind of the mainstream of autism research, I'm not sure that it's driven by what people with autism would want to be the focus. You know, it's not, I don't want to stereotype my research colleagues to say that they're all interested in, you know, being the one to discover the cause or the cure for autism. And hopefully most people have realized that, you know, even if such a thing were possible, it's not necessarily desirable. But I think that there probably is quite a disconnect between what a lot of scientists and researchers are aiming to do, what the funding bodies that are all important in this process are aiming to do, and what people with autism and their families think is more important. And so that, you know, as you've referred to as the lived experience, I sometimes wonder, you know, I do feel that I come across quite a lot of my colleagues who may be brilliant neuroscientists. You know, they can run all the, you know, we've got this fancy lab next door and it frightens me just to go in there just in case I press the wrong button. But I just sometimes question whether they've really ever met somebody with autism because I don't want to say, oh, I've got some special insight into it, but I think it strikes me that unless we actually think about, well, what's important here, we're going to be going down the wrong path in terms of, you know, we may make amazing discoveries, but actually it turns out to be completely irrelevant. And I think perhaps just one example would be the fact that it was only recently when the DSM-5 protocol was published that having issues, whether they were kind of strong interests or strong aversions to sensory things or having sensory processing difficulties was seen to be part of the diagnostic category. And I kind of think, I'm not sure that I've ever met somebody with autism who wouldn't describe themselves as having some issues or differences in terms of the way they process sensory stimuli, however you might describe it. And so you kind of think, well, what were we just not listening all this time? Why has it taken so long to get to that stage? Whereas I think, you know, in a kind of the everyday world of people who work in special schools with children who have autism, who maybe have severe learning disabilities, that sensory difference, that, you know, the love of certain sensory stimuli or the difficulties processing external noise and all that kind of thing, everybody knows that, everybody can see it, but it's just like, well, okay, well, then let's take that as a stepping point for, like, well, what's important here and what we're doing. I've yet to see an autistic mouse, but people spend a lot of time studying them. But maybe I'm just cynical about things I don't understand, I don't know. People get interested in autism for all sorts of different reasons, and obviously lots of people, their interest stems from some personal experience, relative, you know, siblings in particular, perhaps. And I guess that's, it's always interesting to me when I meet a colleague who will tell me, oh, a brother who's got autism, and that's where my interest started. And it's also interesting to know why people that don't have that kind of direct experience, what is it that's attracted them to being involved in the field of autism? I mean, in some ways, luckily for the research autism community, it's a growth industry. I would say if you don't have any kind of direct experience of working with people with autism in their, and their families, then that's what you should aim to do, you know. And whatever that might be, whether it's going working in schools, whether it's working alongside, you know, there's hundreds of local groups run by parents of children with autism to support other parents, to set up services. It's just to try and get a real hands-on experience of what people's day-to-day experiences are. And it's not, you know, there are the obviously stereotypes about the sad children locked in their own little world, but it's not, there's a lot of joy and, you know, amazing experience out there. And a lot of the people that I've met over the years, I kind of think I've learned so much from them. And it questions your values about, well, what do we think is important in life and that kind of thing. But I would just say that if you only see autism from this kind of abstract basis, whether it's as an experimental psychologist or as a molecular biologist or whatever, then I'm not quite sure that you're going to know where the path is, let alone be on the right path.